Welcome to Miller Kane, A True and Exact History, a serialized novel by Samuel Ligon, published for the first time in The Inlander and broadcast by Spokane Public Radio. Miller Kane is made possible by Sprint and The Inlander. Previously on Miller Kane, Lizzie is upset. She's stuck in jail, charged with assault for shooting her estranged husband, Connor. When on TV, she sees her 8-year-old daughter, Carlene, at a vigil for America's latest mass shooting. To be fair, Miller Kane, who's been caring for Carlene, hadn't planned this. Yes, he used to make his living traveling from one mass shooting to the next and conning survivors, like Jimmy Hefner. But this is different. He and Carlene were traveling through Missouri when tragedy found them. And now, Carlene wants to stay and help. At the moment, Carlene's spending the day with one of the town's surviving kids, and Miller has the urge to write. He's been working on a series of biographies of famous Americans for a history textbook, each starting with the same question: hero or villain? But his editor, George, fired him a while back when Miller's stories took a wild turn. Now, here's author Samuel Ligon.
Chapter 8, Part 3. Miller got a table outside on the square in Springfield, where it was too hot for the end of October. They'd head out tomorrow for a few days, and while it didn't seem fair that they could just leave like that, Miller knew the weight of the massacre would go with them. He opened his laptop, nothing from George. It didn't matter. He was writing for himself now. A placard in front of the fountain designated Springfield the birthplace of Route 66, the Mother Road. Another sign mentioned the Ozark Jubilee, where Elvis had never played, but Patsy Cline had, as had Johnny Cash and Buck Owens, Kitty Wells and George Jones, Ernest Tubb, and so many others. It was possible there were people in Springfield untouched by the massacre, but unlikely. Miller ordered another coffee and started to write. Hero Villain 8, Elvis Presley and Jim Jones. This isn't about falling Elvis, full of donuts and pills, but rising Elvis, poor, weird, coming into himself, into country music and gospel and the blues, which he knew, more or less, were the same thing, or something altogether different once combined. There's nothing more American than rock and roll, except jazz and the blues and hot dogs and murder and pills and Jesus and booze. And while we may have invented rock and roll, we also forgot about it for a while until the British reinvented it, by which point Elvis had guns in his boots and dope in his bloodstream all the time. He liked drugs and he liked women. He liked cars, costumes, badges. I wish not to be given a title or an appointed position, he told Richard Nixon. I can and will do more good if I were made a federal agent at large. He spread his credentials across Nixon's desk, a lieutenant's badge from L.A., a captain's badge from Memphis, deputy badges from Hinds County, Cumberland County, Mobile, Alabama. He'd been studying communist brainwashing techniques and drug culture for 10 years, he told the president, and was ready to become a secret agent. He said he needed the federal credentials. Nixon turned to his deputy counsel. Bud, he said, can we get him a badge? Bud could get him a badge. Everybody was always getting and giving Elvis badges and drugs and sex and loyalty, and he gave them cufflinks and Cadillacs in return, plus horses and the aura of his invincibility. He was famous at 19, very famous at 20, the most famous person in the world at 21. He bought his mama a car and a house, and when he bought Graceland, he moved her and his daddy in with him. Colonel Parker is more or less like a daddy when I'm away from my own folks, he said. He called his mother every night from the road. Years later, Priscilla's father said, our little girl is going to be a good wife. But by then, Elvis wasn't much good to her. They were closest when she was 14 and he was 24, right after his mama died, when he was still rising. In high school, he was lonely and had no friends. He wore pink pants and attended the Assembly of God Church, where people spoke in tongues and shivered in the presence of the Lord. No one could believe it when he became famous so fast, igniting such ecstasy in his audience. And then it seemed as if we'd always known he'd become who he was, the king, risen from the commoners. He had all the intricacy of the very simple, Marian Kiesker said. Whatever you were looking for, you were going to find in him. He had greasy hair and a dirty neck. He hung around Sun Records waiting to become Elvis. His first single was Blues on one side, Country on the other, That's All Right, and Blue Moon of Kentucky, but not quite country, not quite the blues, or both and a little more. His manager was more interested in money than music, so money's what they made. Elvis was grateful to the Colonel, attributing his success to him. Elvis would take care of the music, and the Colonel would take care of the business, but business became all there was, bad movies and mediocre records and lots of money. Sun Records founder Sam Phillips said of meeting Elvis in 1953 that he tried not to show it, but he felt so inferior. He reminded me of a black man, Phillips said, in that way. His insecurity was so markedly like that of a black person. Elvis was a hero to most, Chuck D said 36 years later, but he never meant shit to me. He worked at Precision Tool, drove a truck for Crown Electric. Once he started recording, being Elvis became his only job, making music, then movies, except when he was in the Army, when his job was being a soldier and taking amphetamines his sergeant gave him to stay alert. He had a religious experience in the desert, Stalin's face in a cloud morphing into the face of Jesus Christ. He had lots of guns and cars and hangers-on. He had a chimpanzee named Scatter. Miller looked up from his laptop, took a sip of coffee, watching people cross the square. He wanted to focus on rising Elvis, but kept slipping into falling Elvis. Sometimes it was hard to see around the badges and dope and remember how remarkable the man had been, and how completely alone. Miller wanted to capture his vitality, the electricity of his best performances. The chimpanzee would be his transition to Jim Jones, who had chimpanzees of his own, one of whom was found shot in the head among the 900 dead at Jonestown. On a bench by the fountain in the center of the square, a couple sat kissing, untouched by the massacre, at least for the moment. Miller didn't want to write about Jim Jones. He wanted to peel the ridiculous off Elvis, turning him into something beautiful and dangerous again, his ecstatic movement another manifestation of the music pouring out of him. The kissing couple pulled apart, the man holding his hands up in surrender. The woman laughed and leaned back into him. Miller watched them, barely registering the movement of another man by the fountain approaching them. Something was off with the other man. He wasn't Hefner, was too small to be Hefner, but something was wrong. Miller scanned the street, the square, the sidewalks. A flock of pigeons startled the other man as they lifted in flight in front of him, the man flinching, then cocking his head to watch the birds resettle. Miller felt the walls closing in, not wanting to know who the other man was, and then knowing. Connor, the idiot. Not fake Connor or imagined Connor, but actual Connor, not 50 feet away. Miller sank into his seat, face down into his computer screen. At surrounding tables, people were writing, reading, behaving themselves. Miller made himself small. He counted 7 beats of his heart in his ears, and when he looked up, Connor was gone, crossing the street toward the Fox Theater. Miller exhaled, closed his laptop, and lifted himself, silent, invisible, eyes down as he walked into the coffee shop toward the door that would lead him onto a side street. He heard her voice before he saw her. Rice milk, she said, not soy. Does that make sense? None of it made sense, or it was all inevitable. Miller pivoted, fluid, silent, glancing toward her at the counter, all of them here now. And if she was inside and Connor out, the two of them were here in Springfield together. Impossible. Hadn't she shot him? Didn't that mean anything? He glided onto the patio, a shadow. The only way out was over the wrought iron fence enclosing the sidewalk tables. "Miller," she said behind him. Maybe he could knock the fence over, pull his way through. "Miller," she said. Connor was in front of the History Museum now, walking away. "Miller," she said, touching his shoulder. He turned and she was herself, but worn down, washed out. She'd lost a lot of weight in jail. "Lizzie," he said, mouth open, eyes wide, in imitation of surprise. She started to say something, but he talked over her. "Oh my God," he said, opening his arms. "I can't believe." She stepped into his hug. How many times he had dreamed of her coming to him this way, but not quite this way. Across the square, Connor moved farther away. Maybe it was coincidence that Lizzie and Connor were both in Springfield, in which case Miller needed to warn her, protect her, get them all on the road and away from here. "Where's Carlene?" she said, pulling away and looking around as if Carlene might materialize and jump into her arms. On their bench by the fountain in the center of the square, the kissing couple were still kissing, another sign that perhaps none of this was real. "Miller," Lizzie said. "Where is she?"
You've been listening to Miller Kane, A True and Exact History, a novel by Samuel Ligon, published in weekly installments by The Inlander, with archived audio at spokanepublicradio.org/MillerKane. Our theme music is by Indian Goat. If you're just hearing Miller Kane for the first time and want to get caught up, you can now find it as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and the NPR One app. Subscribe for a new chapter-long podcast each Thursday from now until the novel's conclusion. I'm your producer, Chris Messini. Join us next week for the latest episode of Miller Kane.